Jessica Hecht is one of my favorite actors, one of my favorite human beings, actually. She was last seen on Broadway in Arthur Miller's The Price. Before that, she starred as Golda in Fiddler on the Roof and was in the Manhattan Theater Club production of The Assembled Parties. She was nominated for a Tony for her role in A View from the Bridge. She was at Williamstown last year to star in The Clean House with Jane Atkinson and returns this season in The Closet, where she plays a friend of the eternally optimistic co-worker Patricia Penberry, who can't bake enough muffins to stave off her romantic longings for Martin O'Reilly, played by Matthew Broderick. It is always a thrill to chat with Jessica Hecht. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad that we're wearing the same color. Nobody can see, but we're both in pink.
I think of you as a friend. Are we friends? Are we?
I totally think of us as friends. And Sarah, sitting next to me, is also my friend. I listen on the radio to NPR as I'm getting into this region. I listen anywhere that I am to NPR, but I always tell people in the car, oh, these are my friends. So I hope you would say the same.
Well, absolutely. We've been talking to you for years because you've been coming here for years. And I'm curious as to what it means to you. And I assume it's not that hard of a sell when they say, oh, we have a show that you may be interested in doing in Williamstown.
It's not a hard sell because I live here part-time, so that's kind of a lovely thing. But I was thinking about how much I like tradition and personal histories, and it's kind of a lost aspect of people's lives, or at least my life, and a lot of artists don't have the chance to do things ritually, you know, and to come up here every year has been very significant. It's kind of old school, and I really value it.
And when you get to be a part of an ensemble like this, with In the Closet, you were there from the beginning, right? You started in the readings, and the show has moved through the process.
Yeah, we did many readings in New York, and it always gets a tremendous response. People just find it hysterically funny, and that's the great thing about this type of comedy in general to me is the trick is not to analyze why people find it funny, not to try to repeat it because you understand how the joke works. That's my take on my doing comedy. I know there are great comics who understand exactly why people are laughing, but with this comedy and many big laugh shows, the best thing to do is just remain oblivious, and that's what I've sort of done.
I was telling Sarah just before you came in about, there's a moment in the show, there's some great physical comedy that you do in the show as well, and it's so beautifully and perfectly timed, and it just seems perfect for you.
Are you speaking about Matthew's, my love scene?
I'm talking about your love scene, and I'm talking about the scene when he's rubbing your arms.
Yeah, that took a little while. It was. I'm going to make it sound so erotic when in reality it's so goofy, but it was it. For anyone, you can try this at home to try to do something at length when someone is touching your breasts for a long period of time to try to maintain a straight face. Usually the response would be to kiss the person or to flee. In this case, we have to engage in a very long scene. So it took a fair amount of work to balance it out.
And you established quite early that this is given our climate, you established quite early that it's okay that the hand is there.
It is okay, yeah. Hopefully Matthew will, he is probably going to be part of this interview, but hopefully he will hear this, because he's so sweet and so concerned that I'm offended. But I am not offended, and it's refreshing to find somebody so worried about offending me. And my character is really into it.
It's also, I thought, was interesting when I was looking through the work that you've done, at least on Broadway. You've done a lot of Arthur Miller. You've done a lot of drama. But this is just a flat-out comedy, and which you're perfect for, and yet you do some, but not a lot.
Yeah, I don't often do flat-out comedies, and they're really hard, and I don't often repeat things exactly the same way every night, and sometimes for comedy that's very valuable. Great comedians often know exactly how to hit the marks to make sure you get all those laughs, and For me, I guess because I don't do comedy, as I said, straight comedy so often, it doesn't really matter to me if I don't get every laugh, although I do feel a little pained. But maybe that's why I don't do comedies as often, because there's a precision that I think great comedians have that I don't know that I do have. Anyway, but I'm certainly enjoying it. And I certainly started in television that way by doing sitcoms.
Friends being the most notable.
I did. I think Seinfeld was the first sitcom I did. Yeah, I played one of George's girlfriends who couldn't. It was an episode in which we were part of a book club together, and he didn't read Breakfast at Tiffany's, but watched the movie. That was the source of a small argument. Anyway, I used to do those comedies a lot when I was living in Los Angeles, and that same rule applies: where you should not investigate why people laugh; just be grateful they do.
I saw a talk back after the show, and it was interesting because there was a gentleman in the audience who asked you about improv and was under the impression, I guess, that some of it was improvisational, which you were very nice, but seemed to take a little offense at the fact that that would be an idea that you wouldn't be sticking to a script. And I found that fascinating.
Yeah, this comedy especially, there's a rhythm of the language that does sound somehow improvisational to people, and it has taken so much effort to get the lines as close as possible. And I think people watching actors be, for lack of a better word, and it's actually kind of an offensive word to me, but silly, you know, what they perceive of as silly, they believe that maybe they're just kind of goofing off and making it up, when in reality it couldn't be further from the truth, and we're really embarrassed if anything is even off a little bit. We get very embarrassed backstage and kind of beat ourselves up. So I'm glad that people perceive of it as kind of a big rollicky fun time, but it is actually kind of fairly labor intensive.
It's also a lovely comedy because everyone gets their moment. Everyone gets that goofy, silly moment.
Yes, we all get that moment. We've already described my sex scene, but everybody gets something. Everybody winds up with a little sweet takeaway. Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Go back to the reading process. Were Matthew and Brooks always part of that? Matthew, Brooks, Anne, was that the original group?
It was essentially me, Anne, and Matthew, and Ray, who plays Bishop Abadelli, who's wonderful. And so it was in a way originally written for Matthew and Anne, and I believe someone else read my part once, and then just quite different, wonderful, but just quite different, and then. And then it's so funny because she's such a great actor, and I think it's humorous. But it's one of the contenders for the governor of the state of New York who read the part. And I'll leave you to figure out which great actress that is. But she was too busy to follow through, I think. So, and not goofy, is it?
And now we know why she had something on her plate. My perception of you may be completely off, but my perception of you is that it doesn't seem like you have trouble finding the next job, finding the next gig, because you're always working. Is that true, or is that a misconception on my part?
Oh, that's very kind. It's relatively true in that I do a lot of readings and I develop a lot of scripts. It's sort of, you know, not always the case that things line up one after the other, but I am extremely grateful that I've had a few playwrights and a few directors that I've collaborated with, and they keep things kind of slowly percolating. So at this moment, I have like two projects that'll probably come to fruition in the next year or two. And I always have that, and I love that process. And that's, I teach a class in which I teach actors how to work on readings and how to work on developing plays with playwrights, because that's sort of the way I've made my career. And I think it's an extremely valuable and gratifying way to work.
And you've also done a great number of revivals, too. So you have that almost to compare as to what those processes are like.
Yeah. Well, the revival process is really about looking at a great play that has been seen many times as though no one has seen it. And the way to do that is to read the story super carefully and try to think about just telling that story and not doing this great play. So if you were doing Streetcar, which I had the incredible gift of doing up here, you would just think of the story as much as you can. It's about like mindfulness. This is a story of a guy that survived the war and a woman who is barely surviving the death of her whole family, and they meet in this crappy apartment because she's on her last legs and his sister is her sister, and that's about all you have to keep to. But you can't think of Vivian Leigh and Jessica Tandy or Marlon Brando. You just have to think of that story, and I think that's could be said of any of these revivals I've done. You have to insist on thinking of the story and not of the play.
Would you, having done Fiddler, would you do another musical?
I would. I don't know that people would want to hear me sing. I think I have a very passable folk voice. I don't think I have a broader voice, but I love singing. I love doing Fiddler with Danny because he was inspiring in terms of how musicals could be done really quite brilliantly. But I don't know that it would be... I would love to do another musical. For anyone writing a musical who doesn't mind that I don't sing, like, you know, in any way, like, I don't know, Idina Menzel or whoever is a great musical theater singer, I would love it.
Did they come to you, or was that something you sought out when that came about?
Fiddler, I think they came to me because they knew I sang in synagogue. Someone, maybe the great producer Jeffrey Richards used to live in my building with me, or I used to live in his building, and I sing in my choir at synagogue, and they thought maybe the authenticity would be a good match for that production, which I think it was. You know, sometimes they just want people who sing like people. Yeah.
And you and Danny Burstein, as you mentioned, just a beautiful chemistry between the two of you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's part, figuring that out. But we also have a lot of history. His father and my mother went to Hunter College together at the same time. So funny. He's just an incredibly kind man with no pretense. So it was it's pretty easy to be, you know, his friend.
So what's next? When this wraps up, then what are you off to?
Well, I started to put my energy on working with communities that desperately need theater but have no theater in them. I'm going to a Syrian refugee camp the day we finish for almost a month to mount a production of The Tempest with the refugees, directed by Aaron Arbus. So I've been working for almost 2 years since Fiddler on raising money for that. It's called the Campfire Project, and I'm incredibly moved by our community. I raised the money to bring 16 artists, half of whom speak Arabic. So we will be there in Ritzona, Greece, at a camp of 1,000 people, and we'll stage this production.
Oh, my God. First of all, like that makes you cry just thinking of it, but also... What that seems like that would be life changing.
Well, it has. It started at Fiddler actually, because my feeling of the reflections on what was going on with the Syrian civil war and what was going on with these people in Russia was quite similar, and we didn't have time, or it wasn't the right venue to kind of make those two circumstances overlap. But I think there were resonances that were clear, and then I started raising money backstage with bake sales with my amazing dresser and our stage manager Bess Glorioso and Aaron Roth, and we raised almost $30,000 and started. I started that money to piggyback onto going. It's not a new idea. One of my cousins who was in the Holocaust in a DP camp, he did a production of a play called The Gold Diggers, ironic title, by Sholem Aleichem while waiting for asylum in Israel. And so I thought we could replicate that. And the idea of doing The Tempest, a play about people lost at sea, fleeing their country, seemed very resonant. And the great Shakespeare director Aaron Arbus will direct it. But it will be all refugees. And two of our people are on the ground, and I just spoke to them, and it's incredibly moving. The only sadness I have, which is true to the refugee crisis, is that I'm bringing several people who speak Arabic, but the camp has been suddenly flooded by Kurds and Sudanese. So we'll bring some of our company speaks French, which is helpful, and we'll have to figure out the Kurdish element. But it'll be actually profoundly international. And the choreographer is our choreographer from Fiddler, which is ironic, Chris Evans, who works with Chofesh Schechter, because those dances were all tribal. So it's kind of amazing that it's happening.
What is it like to expose these refugees to Shakespeare?
I was there in December to plan the trip, and people are unaware of the fact that most of the people in the camps who are from Syria are very well educated. I mean, I think educated people know that those people are educated. I think the world at large is not always aware. And in Syria, they're often educated in the Western canon of literature. So people there know Chekhov and Shakespeare and Ibsen. So that has been amazing. We told the story to some boys, some young boys there, who didn't know the story. And we told the story of the tempest. And this boy, Muhammad, said, "That is the most beautiful story I ever heard. My grandmother tells these kinds of stories." And that really was very moving. And I don't know what'll be true of the Kurds or the Sudanese. I don't believe that in Africa Shakespeare is as known as in, you know, these countries, these people that are fleeing the Middle East crisis. But the story, think about it. I mean, we are such stuff as dreams are made on. Oh, brave new world. Those are lines from The Tempest. And that's the climate we're living in right now.
If you want to find out more information, you can go to campfire-project.org, campfire-project.org. And there's a donate tab there and also an entire list of all the stuff that you're working on. So many of us, I think, in this climate feel that we're helpless and don't know what to do. Does that help you personally of saying, okay, well, at least I'm doing something?
Yeah, it's oddly coincided with me being just a middle-aged person and feeling like, God, there has to be something more than doing plays for lovely people in New York who can afford to go. There has to be something more. It did coincide with that and wanting to work with people, bring art to people that otherwise did not have it. But this present climate and the refugee climate right now, the immigration issues, people are desperate to help. Sadly, I could have, well, not sadly, because I would like to bring this project to other camps, and we could probably do that in Texas. You know, I just could trade out the six people that speak Arabic for six people who speak Spanish. And that's our goal now. We realize that. And we're also bringing a psychiatrist who's attempting to do a certain type of breath work that they have been doing with people who have severe PTSD. And we will start every session with this 10 minutes of breath work called from this book, The Healing Power of Breath. So it has taken on a very organic physiological aspect, you know, this attempt to use some sort of organic means by which we can all feel a little more calm.
How typical / atypical is this particular camp, Camp Ritsona?
Oh, that camp is atypical in that there has been no gang violence now, and there's a lot of reasons that the camps become dysfunctional because there's no system of law within it or what have you. But that camp is extremely isolated. The trouble with some of these camps is that there is no way to leave, and people are deposited in these very isolated areas, and so there is a desperation that's bred from being in the middle of nowhere on an abandoned military base, which is where many camps are. But the people there are attempting desperately to live in a civilized manner under the worst circumstances.
You're doing something that's so meaningful. Does anger ever creep in?
No, I'm not actually doing something political, so it doesn't creep in that relationship. Sadness creeps in, or, you know, but I'm not really, I don't think of it as, it would be a waste. I mean, in a funny way, you could be angry at Assad and you could be angry at Trump all in the same way, but they all seem equally remote from the mission. And funnily enough, when we went there in December, they felt bad for our circumstance, for our political circumstance. They didn't speak of their own. Doesn't that make you laugh?
It does.
They felt bad for us.
Well, and we're seeing this with this most recent summit that people are coming out and saying, "Oh, I'm sorry you're going through this."
Yeah, they were very empathetic toward us, and they thanked us for not forgetting them, which is really what any person wants to hear. Thank you for not forgetting us, is what they said.
Well, it's a beautiful project. It is called the Campfire Project. You can find out more by going to campfire-project.org, campfire-project.org. Jessica Hecht is in the closet on the main stage at Williamstown Theater Festival through Saturday night. You can find out more about the festival by going to wtfestival.org. You're a delight. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, and you are my friend, so thank you for hanging out with me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WTFestival.org. WAMC.